can't do it, Mom. I just can't do it.
Annie.
Will I ever see you again?
What does your heart tell you?
I hope so. Yes. I guess.
Then we will see each other again.
I will come back and free you, Mom. I promise.
Now, be brave and don't look back. Don't look back.
Welcome, everyone, from across the universe to the Wampa's Lair podcast. Star Wars is for everyone, so pull up a chair, get comfortable, and join the conversation with your hosts, Carl LeClair and Jason Hunt, here in the Wampa's Lair. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another exciting episode of the Wampa's Lair podcast, part of the Thunderquack Podcast Network. This is episode number 555, Top 5, The Phantom Menace Moments. I'm, as always, one of your hosts, Jason Hunt, and with me, the Qui-Gon Jinn to my Jar Jar Binks, we have Carl LeClair.
Are you brainless?
I speak.
The ability to speak does not make you intelligent. Now let's podcast.
Okay.
Oh my goodness! I was telling a friend that we were hitting episode 555, or no, I was telling one of the students at work that we were coming up on episode 555, and they're like, "Oh, you should do an episode about fives," and they were like, "What's 5's CT number?" And I looked it up; it's 5555, so it's 5555. So I was like, "Well, in 5,000 episodes, we'll do an all fives episode, but Jason and I'll be dead by then." So.
Yeah, I'm not sure we're going to hit that number, Carl, but yeah, 555, we got to do a top five here in the Wampa's Lair, though.
Absolutely, and as we continue all our, you know, celebration of Phantom Menace 25th anniversary stuff, of course we got to do top five Phantom Menace moments. And Jason, we did do this episode back in, I think it was episode 281 or 286, something like that, so... About 6 years ago, we did this, so I'm excited to revisit it. I know I've got a couple of new moments that I'm pretty sure were not on it previously, but I still have my staples for sure.
Absolutely, yeah. No, I was tempted to try and go back and find my notebook from that episode when you told me that yes, we have done this again and or before and all this stuff. I was like, I thought we had. But it's been long enough that we can repeat a topic, especially something like this, because things change. We get new listeners. It's been 6 years, you know. I mean, that's the amount of time it took for us to see all three of the prequels in the theaters. So just to give people an idea that's how good, long it's yeah. been since we've done this episode.
that's a really good point. But yeah, so super excited to just talk favorite moments from this movie because goodness, it's so fun, and the fun fest will continue through the rest of April into May, and we're never gonna stop partying to Phantom Menace.
No, never gonna stop. Never gonna. No, I don't know.
Yeah.
I was gonna start singing something, and it just went. So that's
yeah.
So let's get back to Phantom Menace.
Yeah. Before we hop into the episode, just want to plug something that I'm going to be hosting on Sunday, May the 5th. So Star Wars Day weekend is coming up, y'all, just 2 weeks away. My favorite time of the year. And for those of you who follow us on Instagram, and I think I mentioned it even last week on our Bill Moyers George Lucas conversation, that I was lucky enough to guest lecture in a class at the college I work at a week ago, presenting on Star Wars as a pop religion. So I really want to have that conversation again. So if you are interested in hearing me talk about Star Wars and how it acts as a popular form of religion, feel free to join us. I'm going to be doing a Zoom webinar on Sunday, May the 5th at 7 o'clock Eastern time, 7 in the evening, not 7 in the morning. So if you would like to be part of that that experience, that conversation, simply either email us, wampuslayerpodcast@gmail.com, or DM us on any of our social media platforms, and I will send you the Zoom link for that event. And even if you can't make it, but you're interested in the presentation itself, I will be recording the Zoom presentation. So happy to send that to anybody who's interested.
Yeah, it'll be a lot of fun. I'm going to try and make sure I'm available for it as well. Because I'm curious what Carl has to say. It'll be very weird to sit and listen to Carl give a presentation and not be able to comment and discuss it along with him. I'm just going to put that out there.
There's a question period at the end. So ultimately what the presentation is about is looking at just how religions in general function and how Star Wars, specifically the fan community, almost acts as a form of religion. And I'll be diving kind of into each subsequent trilogy and how each trilogy has something different to say about religious import. So if that's anything of interest to you, like I said, just let us know. I'll send you the Zoom link. It's been really fun. It was really fun to get to do this for the class. It was really fun putting the presentation together, getting to put on my Master's of Theology hat once again, and have a little bit more of an academic conversation around Star Wars in that regard. So yeah, if you're interested, like I said, just let us know. I'll send you the Zoom link.
Awesome. But without any further ado, Mr. LeClaire, I believe it is time to start counting down our top five moments from The Phantom Menace.
Oh man, let's do it. It's going to be so wizard.
So wizard, Annie. I'm sure you'll do it this time.
Do what?
Not have an honorable mention, of course.
You don't have an honorable mention? Not even one?
No. Well, Kister's right. I will this time. No. Actually, I don't.
No. Not yeah. For this podcast. We figured since it's 5-5-5, we got to keep it strict to just five. So without further ado, Jason, what is your number five favorite moment from Phantom Menace?
My number five favorite moment, I've labeled it here in my notes, is simply Gungans on the March. And this is, of course, the opening shot from the OG Phantom Menace trailer with the Gungans in the mist stepping out as they are preparing to go up against the Trade Federation on the grassy plains of Boo as they fight for the liberation of their homeworld. And this whole setup as they assemble and get into formation, activate the shield, and then you've got the Trade Federation army coming down over the hill and an opening fire on the shield bubbles that the Gungans have. It's a great sequence. We don't really have anything else like it in Star Wars, so it remains a bit unique, but it's always something that because my favorite part of the movie is basically from that until the end, it always gets me amped up and excited. Just having that, and just the fact that it's where Jar Jar is. I'm a fan of the Gungans and Captain Tarples and all of this, and getting to see them and all the fun little intricacies that they have the Gungans do in the background throughout the whole battle. This sequence, as they open that up, it just gets me all pumped and excited. So that's why it's number five on my list.
It's so good. Yeah. And it reminds me of when George, there's a scene in the beginning documentary, which we'll be talking about soon enough, where George is talking to Steven Spielberg about this ending battle and how he compares it to War and Peace. And it's this ginormous Gungan army marching down into the fields to face down this droid army. And I even love, I love the instrumentation that the Gungans use, kind of like they use this, like, it almost sounds Like that mind.
Didgeridoo.
Thank you. Didgeridoo. Thank you. Thank you. And it's so cool. It's like this woodwind instrument, like calling the soldiers into battle. And yeah, like that iconic shot that we first saw in that trailer all the way back in 1998 of this kind of, you know, this Gungan force emerging from the shadows. It's so incredible. And yeah, facing down this massive droid army, but safe behind their shield protector. I love the technology of those shields.
The technology, the Gungan technology in general is just really cool. So yeah, having taken their shield bubbles that they use for their buildings and turning it into a military, adapting it for military use is really, really neat. Plus you get all the cool various fauna, Naboo fauna that are involved, from the Caddo that they ride to the Falumpa set that pulled the wagons and the Fambas that carry the shield generators. Yeah, I like my Gungans. I know too much. Maybe not too much, but I know a lot.
I love it. Well, my number five also has to do with the Gungans, Jason, and I just call it the swim to Otto Gunga. It's one of these scenes that's just so beautiful looking, and also the score that John Williams gives us in this moment with this kind of beautiful angelic choir sweeping us down under the water. It has this like lilting effect of like, oh, we're descending, but we're descending to this heavenly city almost. It's one of those scenes that just totally grabs me. It grabs my imagination. And, you know, when I was making the list this time, Jason, I've been in the midst of watching a lot of Phantom Menace because my buddy Greg, you know, jokingly challenged me to watch the movie 25 times this year. And I excitedly welcomed the challenge. I'm at 12 already. I mean, that day when you and I were playing around with all your Phantom Menace stuff, we watched the movie 3 times in a row. And of course, it was very much on in the background most of the time. But these are the moments that, like, every time I watch this movie, these are the ones, regardless of what I'm doing, these are the scenes that always grab my attention. And this is one of the first ones that does that, is just that swim to Otto Gunga. And I love the design of the bubble city. It's so beautiful. And I think, you know, the expectation probably of both Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan is, after meeting Jar Jar, it's probably like, well, what kind of city is this going to be, right? Like, almost as if, you know, they see him as a primitive. What is this going to look like? And then as they the question
is he even taking us to a city at all? You know, is he just pulling our leg?
Yeah. And then as they kind of get down into the depths, it's this beautiful expanse of a city. And I love so much the design of it. It's this perfect union of the organic and living in symbiosis with your environment, you know, which is one of the themes of this movie. So I love that swim down to Otto Gunga. It's this like thematic piece of like, you go a little bit deeper to find the gems, you know, dig a little bit deeper and you find that which is worthy in life. And so, yeah, I love this little moment.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's, you know, again, something that we haven't ever really gotten repeated in Star Wars, which, you know, and you don't necessarily want things to be repeated in Star Wars either, but it's just something new and interesting and exciting. And, like you were saying, it's the perfect blend of, organic technology to create something that looks, you know, suspended, you know, in the depths of this lake that continues to drop into the planet's core itself. You know, it's really beautiful.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Plus the music's perfect. So.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's sort of similar to when the Falcon is approaching Cloud City and Empire Strikes Back, and it's the first time we get any sort of choral music in the original trilogy, is you get that kind of that really high soprano note that is meant to mimic like the siren call, you know, in old Greek mythology, as the falcon approaches what looks like this beautiful sanctuary, this safe space, but it's actually a false sense of safety. And here we get angelic voices as they approach the city, but it in fact is sort of a place of sanctuary, even if they're not fully welcome. So, oh, right. Don't worry. This hasn't been our day for warm welcomes.
No, not. Sploosh.
So what is your number four?
My number four is the escape from Naboo, where the Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan escort the queen and her retinue onto the Naboo royal starship. And they make a mad dash for space. You know, obviously, you know, the whole confrontation in the hangar is great, you know, from, you know, halt, where are you taking them? I'm taking these people to Coruscant. Coruscant, that doesn't compute. You're under arrest, you know, all that stuff. But, you know, first of all, the Queen's Royal Starship is gorgeous.
Yeah.
It's an absolutely beautiful ship. And so just have that be our centerpiece as we race out of the hangar and try to make it past the blockade. And then of course we get probably the best introduction of R2 in the entire saga. You know, he kind of gets introduced periodic, you know, reintroduced, in different movies or trilogies and stuff like that. But this is like, this is his shining moment, his shining introduction as we get R2. You know, having to save the royal starship and all on board. And without him, of course, this movie ends rather abruptly. But thankfully, you know, that little droid did it. He bypassed the main power drive and we managed to make it past the blockade and out to space. But yeah, it's such a great scene. It's a fun action piece that, you know, is very well crafted to introduce R2-D2, but it also just has great music. The music of this piece is part lives in my head every time I picture it. So, yeah, it's exciting. It introduces my favorite character in Star Wars, and the music just, you know, amps up the tension and the adrenaline the entire time. So I love this sequence.
You know, or else you get that music quite a bit, Jason.
Where, Carl?
One of the greatest video games of all time, Star Wars Episode One Racer.
Yeah, that definitely plays there. And it is used throughout the prequels.
Yes.
And in the pod race itself, if I recall correctly, the laps.
Yep.
Yeah,
It's at the very end. Yeah, because most of the pod race has no music, right? That's Ben Burtt's sequence, right? George gave Ben Burtt sequences in every movie where it was no music, just Ben. But yeah, it's once his little thing that Sebulba breaks starts to go, that's when that piece of music sets in there. Yeah, and then it's used in the arena battle in Attack of the Clones. It's used in I think it's used when they're like crash landing to Coruscant with Invisible Hand. So so it's used a few times because it's such a great piece of music. Like you said, it really gets the blood going. And I got to say that with the escape, like starting with that really funny exchange between Qui-Gon and the droid commander. But it's my favorite Jar Jar line is when, now stay here and keep out of trouble. Hello, boys.
Hello, boys. Yes. And then, of course, we get, you know, how rude as R2 runs him over, basically, to get out onto the surface of the ship. It's great.
It's so good.
It's a great sequence.
That's going to be for May 4th this year. If anything I enter into that's like a communal setting, I'm just going to start by saying, hello, boys. I love that line so much. It's such a great sequence, Jason, you know, and it really does establish right from the beginning that's kind of R2's thing is he saves the day. That's what he does.
Yes, absolutely. And it's part of why he's my favorite character in all of Star Wars. So of course I'm incredibly biased towards this scene being in my top five in that regard. So, and I don't deny it. But what's your number four, Carl?
That's the point of a top five. It's meant to be biased. It's your picks.
This is true.
But my number four is the opening battle on the Trade Federation ship and Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan just, you know, going to town on battle droids. I love it. It's so, so good. I have said this for years now, but I'm pretty sure that if I had to pick my favorite opening 10 to 15 minutes of any Star Wars movie, it's definitely Phantom Menace. And it really starts with appearing sort of similar to your number five there, Jason, appearing from a different sort of fog. It's toxic gas, but out of this toxic gas, right, we see these two lightsabers ignite and then boom, they're into the fray. And what this established, and this is going back all the way to the first time I saw it, is how intentional George was with desiring to show the Jedi in their prime. The way that they just cut through these droids like they're butter really indicates just how gifted and skilled these Jedi are with their lightsabers. So getting to watch them in this kind of perfected form of a martial art was really incredible. I really love how well this establishes just how incredible of warriors the Jedi are in their prime. And I think the other aspect of this opening battle that I also love so much is that line from Newt Gunray as Qui-Gon is melting the door, right? Like, he is so tenacious of getting to have these negotiations that as he starts cutting down the door and they, you know, close all the shield doors, he immediately knows what he can do. And he just starts to melt the door. And Newt Gunray exclaims, "This is impossible." And I've always loved that because episode one begins by showing us the Jedi in their prime and how that they make the impossible possible. That's always been, you know, I think what we as Star Wars fans love most about the Jedi is that they are extremely aspirational characters. And that's exactly what we're getting as this movie opens. And I also love just that tenacious drive of Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon. They're there on a mission and they're going to just do whatever it takes to see that mission through until droid Eco show up with shield generators, of course. And we see them use Jedi speed for the first and only time in all of Star Wars. I love that they included that because as someone who grew up playing the Jedi Knight Academy Jedi Outcast video games, Force speed was such a coveted ability to use in those games. And I don't know if this is actually factual, but I wouldn't be surprised if that was something George and some of his co-creators were aware of from that video game and said, "Hey, let's show this on screen." It raised the question even back in 99, why didn't Obi-Wan use it to run through the shield doors to get to Qui-Gon quicker at the end of the duel? And if you've not seen this, these are all over YouTube, but there's really funny videos of people show it where Obi-Wan uses force speed, but it's so fast that he falls down the pit. So that's why it's kind of like this funny way of saying it. If he had used it, it wouldn't have worked because it was too short of a distance. He would have fallen into the pit.
Exactly. That or he couldn't stop fast enough if the walls started to close. He nearly ran into it as it is, you know. But yes, no, that's a great scene, Carl. I'm going to save comment.
Okay, cool. Well, then let's get to your number three.
My number three, and I will not be surprised that this is on your list higher. I just have it in my notes as Don't Look Back. This is, of course, you know, you played the scene at the beginning of this episode. It's Shmi saying goodbye to Anakin. This is the emotional touchstone scene for this entire movie for me. It encapsulates all of the good things in Anakin and Shmi's relationship with each other. The love, the kindness, the desire for, you know, other people to thrive. And it's just beautifully done. You know, the way it's shot is great. John Williams just breaks your heart with the music every single time. And then, you know, Pernella August kills it on screen. Jake Lloyd does very well as well. You know, it might be his best scene in the movie for me. But yeah, it's so good. And, you know, we've mentioned it several times, you know, as we've done a lot of these Phantom Menace episodes recently. But if the mood hits me just right, this scene makes me cry. You know, when I'm watching it. So it is, you know, as someone who loves his mother a lot, I feel the emotions in this scene because I haven't had to do something as drastic as Anakin does, but I did move away from her. Drew, it's you know, just one major city over, but I did move. So I understand a little bit, but not a huge, you know, but not to the extent, obviously. But it is the emotional touchstone of the movie for me, and the Phantom Menace is just not complete to me without this experiencing this scene in some way, shape, or form. So yeah, it's my number three.
Yeah, well, I will have more to say shortly. So I'm honestly surprised this was only your number three. I thought this would be number one or two for you.
I was a little surprised it ended up being as low on my list as it ended up being, but yeah, it's there anyways. It's
yeah.
That's the thing is a lot of the items here on my list are interchangeable. Like some of these could switch spots depending on the day, depending on my mood. This is how it ended up being today, but all of these moments in my top five are so tightly squished together that there isn't like a huge difference between, you know, this is my favorite, this is number two, this is number three, you know. It's like, no, they're all in the same kind of top tier bracket for me. I just got to sort it all the way up top there and figure out where they fall. So
that is totally fair. Yeah. I will, like I said, I'll reserve comment for this for a moment here. But
all right, well, then what is your number three?
My number three is Qui-Gon presenting the Chosen One prophecy to the council and
ooh,
talking about his encounter with the Sith Lord. It's honestly, Jason, kind of perfect timing. I just finished rereading Claudia Gray's Master and Apprentice book. If you are a Qui-Gon Jinn fan, and you want to learn to love this character even more, you gotta read this book or listen to this book, whatever is your preference. But it is so good. All that to say, this scene is incredible because it's first and foremost, this is showing us Qui-Gon not being afraid to just speak up to the council. Tell them the facts, like, here's what I encountered. Here's what this all means to me. I don't care what y'all think, because this is what I know. And it starts with positing that he encountered a Sith. And Ki-Adi Mundi, his head matches his ego. It's very large and can't fathom this idea that the Sith have returned. Now, of course, right now, as we're recording this today, Jason, with the Acolyte just over a month away, you know, we're going to have to maybe rethink. Does that line mean something differently? Possibly. We'll find out in a couple of months. But all that to say, even in this scene, regardless of how literal or metaphorical the line may be, Qui-Gon is adamant that he has encountered a Sith Lord. And if you are a Tales of the Jedi lover like Jason and myself, the final Dooku episode when Dooku talks to Qui-Gon right after his meeting with the council and Qui-Gon tells Dooku, yeah, of course they didn't believe me that the Sith were there. What I will say I find interesting is while he talks to Dooku there, he doesn't reveal that he also found the Chosen One, considering Dooku's the one who turned him on to all the prophecies.
But that is interesting.
Yeah. That's okay. Dave Filoni is very good at ignoring novels, so I'll just leave it at that.
well, no, That's a conversation for another day. I think Qui-Gon knew not to mention it to Dooku.
I think, and also like Dooku point blankly asks him like, hey, I heard the buzz is that you encountered the Sith. So that's that's what he brings up. So I don't think Qui-Gon is in the space where he's going to be like, well, and I also found this. So yeah, that's fair.
But I
love that Qui-Gon, this is why Qui-Gon is actually probably my favorite Jedi. Is he's a mystic. While all the other Jedi, especially in his time period, all the Jedi in the Council, they're not mystics. They're bureaucrats at the end of the day. They're religious bureaucrats, but they're still bureaucrats. Whereas Qui-Gon lives for one thing only, the will of the Force. And how does he encounter that? Through the living Force. This is what I love so much about Qui-Gon Jinn. So he is there to tell them these are the truths that I have encountered. And for him, this is what somebody has to do when they encounter the living Force. And Qui-Gon is willing to even be unpopular in order to speak the truth, which is exactly the role of a prophet. If you've ever read any of the prophetic stories in, you know, the Jewish or Christian scriptures, the role of a prophet is almost always to be that of an unpopular person because they have to speak uncomfortable truths to people. Mm-hmm. That's what Qui-Gon is doing in this moment. Everybody looks at him like he's got two heads, except maybe Yoda. Like Yoda is at least like open to it. He is so convicted to speaking this truth, regardless of how it's received. And it's what I love so much about Qui-Gon. And again, like referencing back to Master and Apprentice, we learn in that book how Dooku turned Qui-Gon onto the prophecies, how he started studying them when he was in his teens as Dooku's Padawan, and how he's always believed in them. And one in particular that he studied quite a bit was this prophecy about a chosen one. And Qui-Gon brings that in as I have encountered the Force made manifest, you know, a virgin's in the Force. Who was quite possibly conceived by the midichlorians. Qui-Gon believes that Anakin is the chosen one. And that is something he is so convicted about because for Qui-Gon, that's not just a rational assumption. It's this believed notion because the Force itself brought him to Anakin. And he encounters Anakin and knows exactly who Anakin is. And any other Jedi would have missed it. I mean, right? We even get that with Obi-Wan, you know, since we've picked up another pathetic life form? And while Obi-Wan is still a Padawan, so sure, he may have missed it, but none of the other Jedi of Qui-Gon's time period, except for Dooku, who's now a former Jedi, put any stock in the prophecies, but Qui-Gon did. So when he does encounter Anakin and kind of slowly starts peeling that onion, it becomes very clear to him what the Force is revealing to him through the person of Anakin. And he just stands before the council and just is like, this is it. Here it is. Here's the truth. And I love it.
Right.
Qui-Gon the mystic, baby.
Yeah. And I love it. But, you know, it is one of those things where it's like, wait, I'm sorry. You're referencing a 20,000-year-old prophecy. You really think you're the one who found it because you're the one who's been exploring it? Gosh, come on, Qui-Gon. I mean, that's kind of the response. Because, you know, we get the idea, I think it is in Master Apprentice, that some of these prophecies are like 20,000 years old. They're ancient. I do like the scene. I love it. And the Jedi Council is appropriately shocked. But they move forward because he not only is he, you know, this prophet character, but he has also proven himself to be wise and to be rational about all these things as well. And because of that, he's earned the respect of the council to act on his proclamations, if you will. So, you know, it's not, you know, it is met with some shock, surprise, and some pushback, but it is not discarded. It is not, poo-pooed because Qui-Gon has earned the respect of the council and all the members on it because of who he is and his devotion to the Force in the way that he does things. So, yeah, it's a great scene.
Yeah. Yeah. I love it. Well, we are into your number. I feel like I know what your top two are going to be now. tell us about your number two, Jason.
They are still coming through. This is impossible. Yes. I love it. It is the opening battle sequence of the movie on board the Trade Federation battleship. We get Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan igniting their sabers the first time and just clearing house with these battle droids. And for many of the reasons that you said, it is one of my favorite scenes. The fact that, you know, the Jedi were always the characters I really aspired to be like, I really gravitated towards, even when I had only seen the original trilogy. So when the prequels came along and we finally got to see the Jedi in their prime, in living color and in, you know, action like this, it blew 10-year-old Jason's mind. Like, this was just spectacular. This was amazing. This was incredible. It was something more than I had ever expected, because Luke Skywalker and Obi-Wan Kenobi did not do these kinds of things in the original trilogy, at least not to the extent that Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan are. So having them be able to put on this display for all of us as to what Jedi really are in this era was just so big for 10-year-old Jason, and shaped, you know, continues to shape my enjoyment of the Jedi to this day. So, and then, yes, like you said, it is great to see that they're able to do the impossible in many cases and stuff like that. So yeah, that being that the Jedi are my favorite touchstone in general to Star Wars and you know, the primary avenue that I tend to connect to Star Wars with is through the Jedi. Having this scene in here to be the introduction to what they once were, what they could be again, kind of situation, was ridiculously unreal to me, and it has continued to stay high on the list. Partially because every time Carl and I get together, we quote through this scene at least 3 or 4 times. the scene stays near the top of my list for multiple reasons. And that is definitely one of them, Carl. So,
yeah, it's so good. I've already spoken my piece on it. So I'll get into my number two, which you mentioned just a moment ago, but it is the Shmi and Anakin goodbye scene. As you said, right, this is really the emotional anchor of this movie. It's it also happens like smack dab in the middle of the movie too. It's kind of beautifully placed in the movie. And I think with a person like George Lucas, that's intentional. But it's, you know, and this is coming again out of a little bit of what George shared with Bill Moyers in that documentary we talked about last week. But one of the main themes of Phantom Menace is the theme of letting go. And that's really what the scene is all about, both for Anakin and for Shmi. And yeah, I think in a lot of ways, it's so easy to gravitate to Shmi in this scene as being kind of the idyllic person, because she is capable of letting go. And she does represent this ideal parent who allows their child to grow beyond them. That's almost a similar sentiment to what Yoda shares with Luke in Last Jedi, right? We are what they grow beyond. In a lot of ways, that's true of being a parent too, that there's this trust that your child will grow out of their need for you. Not to say that that means that they don't care about you or that you're not going to be an integral part of their life, but the way a child depends on a parent That is something that any child must transcend in order to become an adult. You have to grow beyond your need for them. And
right.
for a 9-year-old boy to be there, that's not really plausible. Right. That's why the Jedi Order always did take care, you know, take kids as young children, typically 3 and under. Master and Apprentice reveals that Rael Avaros, one of the Jedi characters in that book, he was one of the oldest to be accepted into the Order at the age of 5. So, right, most children that are brought into the Order, it's while they have next to no concrete memories of their birth family. So for Anakin to do that as a 9-year-old boy, well, a 9-year-old, and especially an enslaved boy, his whole life is wrapped up in Shmi.
Right.
But Shmi, of course, is willing to let him go because her love is so much bigger than anything else. But this is going to become the central issue for why Anakin is going to fall, is this fear of being taken away from the people he cares about. He's never able to quite heal from that rupture. And, you know, I think something, this is in the, documentary that came out with Rise of Skywalker, and J.J. Abrams and Chris Terrio, in my opinion, wrongfully believe that the great sin of the prequel trilogy was Luke and Leia being separated in Revenge of the Sith. For them, that was the big thing that needed to be remedied. I don't think they could be any more wrong, but that's not hard to believe because Chris Terrio and J.J. Abrams don't properly respect the prequel trilogy and therefore don't understand it. But to me, the great sin of the prequel trilogy is right here, is Anakin being taken away from his mother. That's the big rupture, not Luke and Leia, not even close. but this is going to be the kind of focal point for where everything about Anakin's downfall is going to be manipulated. So that's another right. huge part of it. And I think what's huge here as well is Anakin is leaving with Qui-Gon. So he's not just leaving with some arbitrary Jedi, right? It's not some random Jedi who stumbles across him and just says, hey, you have the Force. You have Force sensitivity. Come with me to Coruscant. You're going to be trained as a Jedi. No, but even though this has been a very truncated experience of all of 24 to 36 hours, but in that brief period, there is a bond formed between Anakin and Qui-Gon. This is right. somebody that Anakin can trust. And I always love the fact that Qui-Gon insists that he tried to free Shmi as well, right? Even all the way back to the gambling with the chance cube before the pod race. Mm-hmm. Qui-Gon says, I wager my pod for the boy and his mother, which this would be a great what if. What if he had freed them both? What would that have looked like? That's a topic for a totally different day when we do what if scenarios. But Qui-Gon was ardently trying to free Shmi as well. I think he understood that taking Anakin away at this volatile age was going to be very traumatic and actually wanted to keep Shmi in the picture. Again, who knows what that would have looked like, but he tried to. But the fact that he wasn't able to do it, Anakin is able to leave trusting Qui-Gon, and Shmi also trusts Qui-Gon. And when he leaves with Qui-Gon, it was the right move because he left with Qui-Gon. Qui-Gon was the right person for Anakin to leave with, but without Qui-Gon in the picture, the Jedi Order of this period was not the right place for Anakin to wind up at 9 years old, as we're going to learn in Attack of the Clones and Revenge of the Sith.
Well, it still may have been, but he was then manipulated and twisted by someone who did not have his best interests at heart.
That's a good point, yeah.
But, you know, and the other thing, you said the part of the themes that, you know, we talked about, you know, George Lucas talked about in The Phantom Menace from the Bill Moyers interview is letting go. And, you know, this is Anakin does, to an extent, let go here in The Phantom Menace. But then he feels as if that faith that he had in letting go, first is severely damaged with the death of Qui-Gon at the hands of Darth Maul, and then is completely crushed when Shmi dies in Attack of the Clones, which is what causes him to be unable to let go moving forward. And that drives him further and further into Palpatine's arms. So, but yeah, it's it's a beautiful scene, and so much of the prequel trilogy hinges on this scene, on this moment, with Anakin and Shmi saying goodbye. It really is, you know, the foundation of so much of Anakin's motivation for the rest of the trilogy.
Yeah. Yeah. And the one last thing I want to mention about the scene, is just the way that the Force theme is played. Cause it's beautiful. Let me just cue that up here real quick. Here we go. Now, I am not our good friend Ashton Sherritt, you know, who is a musical genius, and of course the likes of David W. Collins as well. But what I do find really beautiful, this is one of my favorite renditions of the Force theme across the entire saga, and the Force theme is being played on horns. It's kind of this, I don't know, almost like triumphant, kingly statement of the Force.
Noble.
Thank you. That's the word I'm looking for. Thanks, Jason. But underneath it, harmonizing with it, are these really sentimental strings, right? So it's the Force itself is there. It is accompanying Anakin on this journey. This is, in fact, the will of the Force. And also at the same time, it's this moment of loss. And there's a sentiment of sadness within that too. So I love that the music is so beautifully juxtaposed there of like nobility and stepping into one's purpose, while at the same time stepping into one's purpose often means kind of a sad letting go of what came before. I think this is one of the most beautifully important scenes in the entire prequel trilogy.
Absolutely. 100% agree with you on that.
Yeah. So, Jason, I feel like we probably have the same number one.
Probably.
If I'm wrong about this, I know I'm not. So shall we talk about the Duel of the Fates?
We shall. I will say we probably will be focusing on different aspects of the Duel of the Fates, because the Duel of the Fates is a long sequence. But yes, Duel of the Fates is my number one favorite moment here in Attack of the Clones. The Phantom Menace. Why did I say Attack of the Clones, Carl?
I
don't know.
Hey, it's a really good movie too.
It is. but we're not celebrating 25 years of Attack of the Clones this year. So
yeah, three more years, Jason.
Three more years. Yes. The moment, though, for me with Duel of the Fates is really sort of the section that kicks it off. You know, we kind of finish out the hangar battle there on Naboo in Theed. The starfighters take off. Anakin is hiding in the cockpit. And then we get the reveal of Darth Maul. And of course, this is the shot that was in all the trailers as well. It is one of the most, epic moments in the entire film. And then the rest of this opening segment of the Duel of the Fates really kind of is what really draws me in. It's the beginning of the lightsaber duel. Padme trying to get out of the hangar, being trapped by the destroyer droids. And then Anakin launching his own starfighter into space with the help of R2 in order to, and saving Padme along the way. So this whole section of the Duel of the Fates, the opening refrain of the Duel of the Fates, if you will, is really sort of the part of this that I kind of lock in on, because it really is, it's what takes the end battle sequence that we've had so far and ramps it up into high gear. It's like you think what we had before was good. You ain't seen nothing yet. Let's turn it up to 11 and blow your socks off. So yeah, that's part of why this opening section of the Duel of the Fates is really my favorite part of it. But yeah, Duel of the Fates, by far, the choreography, the music, all of it is, it's just so great. And of course, we've talked multiple times in the past about how, you know, the track is titled Duel of the Fates. Sound on the soundtrack is called Duel of the Fates. And so we just sort of call this battle the Duel of the Fates. And it really is a battle for the future of Anakin Skywalker. And unfortunately, we lose.
Mm-hmm.
Because we lose Qui-Gon. You know, that there's still hope. There's still, things still could turn out fine for Anakin. But the likelihood of his being manipulated and turned against us and making the wrong choices in the future exponentially increase with the loss of Qui-Gon Jinn. And it is sort of an interesting point to see that this battle, this fight is potentially one of the most important fulcrums in the whole prequel trilogy, on which, you know, a lot of the tragedy hinges. So
yeah, you know, and that point you're making right now, I was never aware of that until Dave Filoni randomly went into this during that Mandalorian behind the scenes documentary. Totally.
Yes.
Kind of out of left field. You know,
he took all the directors around the table there to church.
Yes, he did.
He was like, all right, here's what you really need to
know. Yeah, here's what you need to know. And they were enraptured. As was all of Star Wars fandom.
Yes.
But yeah, I never thought of it that way. I mean, I'm not a chance. I did not think of this. I mean, to me, this Duel of the Fates, this kind of epic orchestral piece John Williams wrote, also was, mm-hmm. it was thought of more of just like, this is that climactic Star Wars battle of good versus evil. That's how right. John Williams conceived it. I think that's how George saw it. And specifically with the music, was that age old struggle of good versus evil. Right. Filoni now, obviously with hindsight of now being removed from the prequels all these years and being able to reflect on it and look back on it, was able to see how it's something even so much more. It has so right. much to do with Anakin, as you were just saying, right? He talks about how this is going to decide the fate of Anakin Skywalker. Will he be brought up by the Force Mystic Qui-Gon Jinn or this very, very young, unseasoned Padawan Obi-Wan Kenobi? That's really what's at the heart of this fight. But yeah, you know, going back into it for me, I mean, I love, Jason, that you mentioned, right, those doors opening, that music hitting, Maul looking up. Also, what's also really cool, I enjoy a lot in this moment, is when the doors open and Maul is revealed, watch Padme. She actually kind of runs up like she's ready to just start shooting at him. It's really cool. Like, she actually runs right up. Watch it next time y'all are watching and just notice how much she quickly runs to the head of the pack there, like she's ready to go to battle. And it's almost as if Qui-Gon calls that off by saying, we'll handle this, right? I mean, Maul probably would have made minced meat of most of the Naboo soldiers there.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it is this really epic thing. Now, Jason, I have a fun posited question I've been thinking about, and I've seen some speculation about this, or just this question kind of floating in the ether in the last couple of weeks with all the Phantom Menace love going around. But what if they had not revealed in the trailer Darth Maul's double-bladed lightsaber, right? That blew our minds away in the trailer. But what if they didn't show that in the trailer? And the first time we saw him extend that second blade was in theaters. Would that have impacted us in a different way, you think?
I don't know. I don't necessarily know, because it's there's nothing beyond the fact that it's just incredibly cool.
Yeah.
You know, and it gives him it evens the playing field, because he's fighting against two Jedi, and it evens the playing field. It puts them all on the same level. I don't know how you would have been able to get away without showing a double-bladed lightsaber, especially with all of the merchandising.
True.
That came out.
That's a really good point. Yeah.
But so when you have, you know, when you're selling double-bladed lightsabers in Walmart,
yeah,
you might as well put it in the trailer, good I point. Suppose.
Yep. Yeah. So yeah, and so and that's actually a really good point, because putting it in the trailer, that also that predates all of the merchandise too. So
right,
and it helps sell it. So not and
exactly.
I don't mean that from like a purely business sense of like let's put it in there to sell more toys. I'm very much not saying that, but just this will blow people's minds, and then you know we want to sell this stuff. We want to get it out there beforehand. So let's not spoil it through an action figure. Let's show it to people.
Right. Exactly.
So that's a good point.
Yeah,
that's a really good point. But you know, so I love that you mentioned this opening part. But for me, Jason, I think my favorite part of the duel, and it's the first time, and I know I've, you know, I've mentioned this before on the show in the past, but it's the first time I ever consciously remember getting goosebumps in a movie theater and literally sitting on the edge of my seat. As exciting as the opening was, we had gotten to see a lot of those shots between the trailers, TV commercials, the music video. We got to see some of that. But my favorite part is actually after Anakin is blasted off and he's like, it's on autopilot, try to override it. And then we get this incredibly awesome shot down from the top of the Theed hangar of the three of them just going at it. I just, you know, 13-year-old Carl was just like, I can't believe this is real. And I'm here for it. Like, thank you, God, for making me and for making this movie through George Lucas. you know, it just blew me away, Jason. Like, I've never felt anything like that before. And I'm really sad to say that when it was re-released in, I think, 2015 in 3D or 2014. No, not 2015. Whenever it was.
It's like 2012 or 2013, I think.
Yeah, something like that. I didn't quite have that same effect. I'm really excited to see it in theaters again in a couple of weeks, though, and be ready for it. But also in that part when Qui-Gon gets kicked down and Obi-Wan is just so confidently twirling his lightsaber, just walking at Maul. And Maul, you know, picks up the broken down battle droid and throws it at the door hand, you know, the door mechanism to open the door. That was also something I don't think I noticed at first because I was just so caught in it. And then when I first got home release of it, we always had a full screen. My mom was always like, right. Oh, get the full screen. You don't want anything getting cut off. But obviously what in actuality is if you get full screen, that's where things get cut off. I never saw that.
Right.
I never saw the droid because it's cut out, right? If you don't have the widescreen version. So I just love that. Like the tenacity of Maul there and kind of the quiet confidence of Obi-Wan. And then, of course, like as the duel goes on, it just keeps getting more and more epic and exciting. And I always remembered, again, going back to the first time I saw it, when Obi-Wan is looking after he's been, you know, kicked down and has that long fall, is he's looking up at Qui-Gon and Maul going at it. I remember even in 99, seeing it the first time, I remember saying to myself, oh, God, he's going to watch his master die. Like it just dawned on me, even though we got the title of the damn track on the soundtrack, Qui-Gon's Noble End. And of course, we knew he wasn't going to, you know, be around for the long haul because he's never even mentioned in the originals. But it was in that moment where I was like, oh, I think this is it. Like, I think this is where Obi-Wan's going to see that happen. So, I mean, it was delayed a little bit. But another thing that this duel also, a question that came up from this duel that people have played with for going on 25 years now is, did Obi-Wan channel the dark side as he goes running through, you know, to after Qui-Gon's been cut down and he runs at Maul? You know, people have been asking this question for 25 years. Does he channel the dark side? I mean, I want to hear your response in a second here, Jason, and I'll give my thoughts on it too. But I want to point out how awesome it is. And I don't know if this is George's direction or just Ewan McGregor doing this himself, but as he starts kind of like bouncing on the balls of his feet as he's getting ready for that door to open, I just love that. Like this is that bull in the little confinement just waiting to be let out, right? Like he's ready to charge into it. And from that, right, people just people were interpreting in 25 years ago is, ooh, I think Obi-Wan touches the dark side. So Jason, 25 years later now, I'm asking you, what do you think? Does he?
I don't think so. It's been an interesting discussion. I've never come down on the side of yes. Is he angry? Yes. But I think he's channeling that anger into a fierce focus and determination. I don't think he's not reaching into the dark side. There's a difference between anger and the dark side. You know, yes, fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering. But it's how you treat that anger. It's how you treat that fear. It's you know, whether or not you sit in it, you let it take over you. I don't see the anger taking over Obi-Wan. Is he angry? Absolutely. It's not, but it's not taking over him. He's channeling it. He's using it to, you know, focus and to have this determination that it's up to him now. And he's got to step up and take out Maul. So I don't think he ever touched the dark side. What about you? Where have you been on this discussion?
Yeah, I'm with you. I don't think so either. And I think, you know, maybe 10 years ago, I may have said, yeah, he touches it for a second. But I don't think so. You know, I think one of the things people love so much about Obi-Wan is that he is kind of the premier Jedi. And I think, you know, to your point, like, yes, he's definitely angry and upset here. And he also recognizes what a threat Maul poses. So I think he's if anything, he's anchoring himself in his Jedi resolve of I have to defeat this Sith. Right. There are Sith out in the galaxy again, it is my job as a Jedi to do that. So I am going to just focus into the most hardened warrior I have ever been. And I'm going to go get him. Right. And I don't not the dark side. That is him just focusing into warrior mode, which is an attribute of being a Jedi. So, I don't think so either. I mean, sure, whatever. If I'm not offended if he does, but I just don't think that that's what it's about.
So, no. Yeah. And I think part of the issue is that when people talk about the Jedi, it's, you know, they're not allowed to even feel sad or fear or anger or anything like that. And I don't think that's quite right. Because everyone has those feelings. Everyone experiences those emotions, but it's what you do with it. It's how you channel it. It's how you don't let it take control. You let it wash over you. You redirect it into something more positive. You know, whatever tactic each individual Jedi has to utilize that is how they avoid touching the dark side, if you will. You know, characters like Darth Maul and like Darth Sidious live in the rage. They live in the fear, the manipulation, the anger, the suffering, and they live to create those scenarios on other people as well. And it's what drives them. So it's a selfishness, not a selflessness.
Right. But. Yeah. And that's a great point too, is I did want to make sure to mention that, you know, part of this is also Darth Maul's perspective. Maul's loving this. This is, you know, he loves the fight. He's relishing it. And, you know, a few weeks ago we talked about Queen's Peril with Tiara, and we actually get some indication in that. We get a couple of little POV from Maul's aspect at the start of the duel. And he had already been in the Theed hangar area and kind of mapped out the space. So when it confronts them there, he knows where he's driving them to. Maul is driving this fight. It looks like the Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon are pushing him back, but it's actually Maul drawing them to this spot because he knew it would divide them. He could divide and conquer them using the grass. Right. And that's something that's in the Queen's Peril novel, which is really exciting to read. But, you know, but Maul is relishing this. He's enjoying the fight, and he isn't, you know, he has been schooled very well by Darth Sidious to be a hater of the Jedi. So he's finally able to, right? He doesn't get many lines in the movie. But of course, his most famous line is probably, "At last we will reveal ourselves to the Jedi. At last we will have revenge." This is him getting to finally do that. You know, as much as Obi-Wan in that scene is chomping at the bit to go get Maul, this is Maul's probably entire existence has been waiting to just throw himself at Jedi. I love the shot of after he cuts down Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan yells no, and he's glaring at Maul, and Maul is basically smiling at him. Like he is loving, he is egging him on. He's loving this.
Yeah, no, like a predator enjoying the struggles of it's his prey that he's already mortally wounded, you know.
Right.
Toying with his food. Like the Maul is I hesitate to use this analogy, but Maul is in heaven. So because heaven isn't necessarily a place for Sith, but like this is if there is a heaven for Sith, this is it. And then of course Obi-Wan puts an end to that almost immediately, and it's why he's so, you know, out for revenge when he gets put back together in the Clone Wars, because Obi-Wan cuts him out of all the machinations right here.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah. and you know, this particular duel is one of the most beloved duels across Star Wars. I think it's a toss-up between this and the Anakin Obi-Wan fight in Revenge of the Sith for fandom in general as what their favorite fight is. I don't understand how you could even think the Anakin Obi-Wan duel is nearly as cool as this, because in my opinion, it doesn't even come close. that's my opinion, though. But that said, I think what this fight also did, though, was, and also in 1999, like people had digital cameras, their own things. The amount of fans that just started trying to choreograph the fight itself or choreograph their own versions of it. I was listening to my buddy Greg on a podcast last week talk about how, and I never knew this. I love that he told this story, and I immediately texted him and was like, I need this video. But apparently when he was in high school, when he first saw it, he and his friends videotaped their own Duel of the Fates. Like they reenacted the duel, and I would give anything to see that. But I did the same thing with my cousins. You know, I've told this story before. We would reenact Duel of the Fates in the basement. I was reenacting it in my backyard all the time afterwards. And we saw so many people popping up online filming lightsaber duels. And that all grew out of people's love and fascination with the choreography that Nick Gillard gave us with Duel of the Fates.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so great. And yeah, I too was running around in the backyard with lightsabers or lightsaber stand-ins, you know, reenacting these duels, reimagining them, and it, you know, all of the Jedi action in this movie set me up to just explode in this regard when Attack of the Clones came out. So I'll leave it at that. But yeah, it's so good. It's so, so good.
Yeah.
And yeah, like you, Carl, I cannot wait to see it on the big screen in just a couple weeks.
Yeah.
Again.
Yeah. I mean, I think, and this would actually make a great topic for an episode down the road, Jason, but like just talking about what moments in Star Wars have transcended the screen itself, like that actually had an impact on culture, right? And thinking of most recently, like Grogu was something that broke into pop culture, right? Regardless of whether you were a Star Wars fan or not, you knew who Baby Yoda was, or if at least a little more schooled, you at least knew it wasn't Baby Yoda and his name was Grogu, but you know, it broke the thing. Everyone in pop culture knew the line, "I am your father," right? Like it broke out of, and I would say Phantom Menace did that with Duel of the Fates. Duel of the Fates, it broke into popular culture. It made sword fighting, lightsaber fighting, it made it something on the cultural map, which I think is just incredible. And I would say it is probably the most impactful thing in popular culture that came from the entire prequel trilogy was Duel of the Fates. The way it just impacted culture, it probably was that. So,
yeah. And everything else that, you know, came out of the prequels that made it into popular culture kind of rode the coattails of Duel of the Fates to get there.
Absolutely.
So.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Between the music and the choreography and just the iconic look of Anakin, Obi-Wan, or excuse me, Anakin, Qui-Gon, and Darth Maul. Gosh.
Obi-Wan, Qui-Gon.
Obi-Wan, Qui-Gon, and Darth Maul. Not in that fight.
He'd have been killed very quickly.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yes. Obi-Wan, Qui-Gon, and Darth Maul. Just the iconicness of the music, the scene, the characters, and the choreography. It is rightly so the most iconic moment from this movie, from The Phantom Menace, and is what has transcended nerddom, geekdom, to make it into pop culture.
For sure. Yeah. There you have it, folks. There are our current top five, you know, and maybe when we do this again for its 30th or 35th anniversary down the road, we'll have different answers. But those are our current top five Phantom Menace moments. And, you know, as always, we welcome yours. You know, we'd love, even if you don't want to send us all five, if you want to just send us your favorite moment from Phantom Menace, we love hearing this stuff from folks.
Absolutely. We had a blast, you know, episode 555, doing a top five with more Phantom Menace love here in the Wampa's Lair. We'd love to get you jumping in on the fun as well. So, Carl, if people do want to weigh in, give us their favorite moments, maybe even just their favorite part of Duel of the Fates, you know, because I'm sure that's going to be a big one on the list for people. Where can people get in contact with us?
Yeah, we are over on Instagram at The Wampa's Lair. You can also follow us on Twitter at Wampa's Lair, or always feel free to email us at wampaslairpodcast@gmail.com. And as I said at the top of the episode, if you're interested in participating in the Star Wars as Pop Religion webinar, Zoom webinar, let us know. Email us, DM us, whatever you want. I'll send you the Zoom link.
Yep, and that's May 5th.
Sunday, May 5th at 7 p.m. Eastern.
Yes, absolutely. Anything else, Carl, before we close out episode 555?
This was possible.
This was possible, and this was pod racing. thank you, everyone, so much for listening to episode 555 of the Wampa's Lair podcast, Top 5 Phantom Menace Moments. For Carl, I'm Jason, and we'll see you next time here in the Wampa's Lair.